Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And here I am, Peter R. Bregan, M.D. Peter, to you and to all my other friends, glad to be talking to my great audience again, leaders in the field, and something screeching awfully in the background. That was my door. Okay, there's my guest. I won't even tell you about him yet. You've already heard his door screeching.
That's right.
Don't forget, folks, my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. It's the book I've written so that the people who want to really get a deep understanding of where guilt, shame, and anxiety comes from, where anger and numbing comes from, and how we can surmount these things, how we can actually transcend, move past this stuff, and live by the values we want to live by, and to live more happily and with much more profound satisfaction. My screeching friend in the background from Australia, his name is Bob Jacobs. Bob is an old friend of mine. He used to be in Florida. He's an American, moved to Australia. You may or may not want to get into that today. He's a psychologist. He's a lawyer. He's the author of Perfect Children, Perfect Parents, Changing the World by Celebrating Our Perfection. He works in Australia as a clinical psychologist and a family law solicitor and a family dispute resolution practitioner. He's deep into the issue of family resolution and communication. I'll let him tell you more about his organizations. He's really a child advocate and has, and that's how I got to know him. I got to know him decades ago when he was standing up in Florida for not drugging our children. That was in days before he became a lawyer. He was a psychologist alone in those days. So, Bob Jacobs, welcome to the show, sir.
Peter, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure being in touch with you, and it's such a pleasure being able to talk to you and to your audience. So thank you very much. I'm quite excited about this.
Well, both Ginger and I were very pleased at the thought, which came to us out of the blue, of what's Bob doing? We haven't been in touch with him for such a long time.
So it periodically happens to me, too.
Yeah, pick up anywhere you want, Bob, on what you've been doing, what matters to you right now, because whatever you're doing is going to be important and interesting.
Well, I very much appreciate that. Yeah, I thought maybe I could start off with now and then talk about how I got to this point, because so much of it has to do with you and your work, which, you know, is such a seminal point in my professional and personal development. Like you say, almost 30 years ago was, I think, the first time you and I spoke. Of course, we were both teenagers then. I hope no one is doing the math. Anyway, so what I'm doing right now, I live in Australia. I'm a dual citizen. I'm still an American citizen, an Australian citizen. I've lived here for about 7 years now. And, that's not right, 6 years. And I run the Parenting Center. Increasingly over the course of the last 10 years or so, which I, again, kind of dovetailed with me being a single parent, my personal and professional interests have really focused on parenting. But as I think you know, it's for me anyway, it's a bigger picture than that. It's about why human beings are not happier. Well, you know, there's a statistic going around in Australia that says that more than 50% of Australian adults use some sort of substance to get through the week, and whether that's prescribed drugs like antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs, or whether it's smoking a joint or having a couple of glasses of wine every night to wind down. To me, the question always comes up, why are we so unhappy? You know, and I think that's really the core driver behind the parenting center, the idea being that I believe that if we raised children in a very different way, that we can change the world one child at a time. So I think, you know, my journey has been from trying to think that, you know, change happens from the top down to recognizing that change happens when people change. Change happens from the bottom up. And, you know, I live in a kind of an alternative community here in Australia, and I see it in my community. There's dozens of families who are raising children alternatively, and, you know, there's qualitative difference in children who are raised differently. So, you know, I'm not necessarily right about anything, but I've become increasingly focused on parenting as the most important job that we do, and also as the most real and meaningful way to change the world.
Bob, tell us about the alternative community. I don't know what it is. I think it would help people a lot get a sense of your values and the context in which children around you are being raised.
Yeah, and this will actually dive a little bit into some history stuff. So, you know, I don't want to put anyone to sleep, so just to cut me off if it's too boring. But, yeah, so I wound up, and again, we can talk a little bit more about this, but I wound up running into some political difficulties in America having to do with being very outspoken on my concerns about the labeling and drugging of children, essentially for no reason other than the fact that their behavior was not pleasing to adults, parents, and teachers. I became really interested in that on a clinical level, and I became really interested in that on a political and social level. And the more interested I became in it, the more outspoken I was about it, with some very difficult ramifications, as I know has happened to you and has happened to so many of us who try to speak out on this issue, you know, because there's a tremendously entrenched power structure that is invested in stilling voices that are presenting a different point of view. In any event, I wound up, partly as a result of all that, I wound up going to law school as a second career. I went into law school in the year 2000. I went to law school with the idea that it would help me to be a more strong children's advocate, that I could have a stronger voice, that I could, you know, essentially go to the judge when there was a problem. I've learned a lot since then. But when I was in law school, it was all about human rights and children's advocacy. And in 2002, I asked to do a externship in international children's advocacy. And the law school, which was the University of Florida Law School, supported the idea. They said, if you can find a placement, we will support it academically. And so I essentially started writing to English-speaking countries because I only speak one language, so I was a little limited there. And I found a place in Australia where I had never been, but had always wanted to, that was called Youth Affairs Network of Queensland. And this is actually quite an amazing story. You'll get a kick out of this. But they were looking for an intern to come out here in our summer or their winter, which would be like June, July, and August. My children weren't with me for those, like, 8 weeks or so, and so I could do it. And they sent me a list. They said, we have four initiatives that we're looking for someone to get involved in, and do any of these interest you? And the reason it's a funny story is because number one on the list was the overuse of medication on children. And, you know, to this day, 13 years later, I've never seen the rest of the list because, of course, I just thought this was, you know, it was heaven intervening. And I wrote back immediately and said, yeah, my, you know, this is the focus of my professional career. I would love to do this. And so I came out to Australia, spent that summer researching the issue out here, wound up writing a, I don't know what you would call it. It was longer than a paper. It's probably 120 pages, but it's called Queensland Children at Risk, the overuse and overdiagnosis of psychiatric, something like that, in children. And, of course, what I found was quite horrible, quite reminiscent of the situation in the United States. Different. There was probably a little less polypharmacy here than in America, but still very widespread, very arbitrary, people writing prescriptions without meeting children, parents advocating, parents and teachers overtly advocating to drug children for behavioral control. So it was quite horrifying. Anyway, my point is, in answer to the circuitous answer to your question, is so the very when I was out here the very first time, which was 2002, during doing this externship, I was looking to be a tourist on the weekends because I wasn't working, and I wanted to see as much of Australia as I could. And one of the things it said in the tour book was to come up to this area, which is called the Sunshine Coast Hinterlands, because there's supposed to be all these kind of funky, you know, artistic, hippie-ish communities. Anyway, so the first day I came to the community I now live in, I drove up and there was a big commotion because there was a huge protest rally going on. And it's actually quite well known throughout this. Queensland is the state in which I live. And it turns out that one of the big grocery companies was trying to, or had bought some land on a creek that was a platypus environment. You know, it was a protected environment, but they had bought some land and wanted to build a grocery store. And the community had banded together to protest this. And, you know, people were marching on the streets. Although I didn't see it personally, later on, people were tying themselves to trees so that they couldn't be bulldozed. And, of course, for me, this just felt like heaven. You know, I grew up in New York and spent a lot of time in Greenwich Village, you know, during the late 60s and 70s, and early 70s. And this just felt like almost like coming full circle to another place where social activism and human rights and, you know, fighting for ecological issues was really, really important. I just fell in love with this community. And I made the decision, if I ever have the opportunity, I would love to move to Australia. I would love to live here. And that's what happened. My kids became adults, went off to uni in their own careers. And once I didn't need to
what
be there
was
for
that,
them.
What year was that you moved to Australia?
2008.
So you've been there 7 years. So catch us up now with getting involved with the community and your work.
Yeah, and it is 7 years. It's early in the morning here, so I added it up wrong. But you're right, it is 7 years. So the community it's a very interesting community. It's there's quite a few retirees here, and so that portion of the community is possibly even a little bit conservative. But it's also sort of a mecca for young families. There's a alternative school here where people come from different parts of Australia to take their kids to this school. And there's very much an ethos of New Age stuff and, what we might call hippie values. You know, there's a lot of, for example, there's a lot of alternative parenting. I wrote my parenting book in 2011, and I had a number of people come into my office and say, you know, I've been doing that for years, or I could have written that book. So it's almost like, and this is the kind of thing people in my community would this would resonate with them, it's almost like it was an energetic thing that drew me to this town, which is called Mullaney, because there were already people doing and believing and embracing a lot of the same values that I embrace and that I wrote about in the book. So it's been really great synergy for me to live here and have my practice here.
Politically, it sounds like it would be to the left, even though you got some conservative older people concerned with the environment, concerned with alternative education.
Yep.
Probably with an economic bent that's more progressive than free enterprise. Is that, excuse me, is that basically so?
Yeah, it is basically so. It's been, as with everything, it's been a journey of discovery for me because, you know, I think I probably came in with some idealistic expectations about the community, which, of course, you know, realism and idealism are often at odds. And I think one of the things that I've learned for me and maybe for others as well is that we disappoint ourselves by comparing what is to what some, you know, abstract idea we have of what should be or what could be. And so I think for me, I probably went through and periodically even go through, you know, if I see something that's overtly materialistic or overtly capitalist, not that I am not those things as well, but if I see something external to me here in the community, there's always a little bit of a pang of, oh, I didn't think that would happen in Mulaney. You know, but that has nothing to do with Mulaney. That has to do with me and my expectations.
How would you characterize the school? Does the school approximate your own views on child rearing? And give us a capsule of what they are.
Oh, that's very, very interesting. Now, you, there's two primary schools in Mulaney. One of them is a state school. State school is the term in Australia for public school. So one is essentially a public school. It's very, very traditional. You know, and again, we're all doing the best we can. There's lovely people there who, you know, are committed to children and are doing what they believe is in the children's best interest. So, you know, I don't so much do the idea that some of us are more altruistic than others. You know, we're all doing the best we can from our own perspective. But to me, it's a little bit of a shock how traditional the school is. And actually, I can talk a little bit more about schooling here because
no,
it's become
quite... What I would really like to focus on, Bob, is your unique view and the school that seems to come closer to yourself. I want to get it.
Okay.
You know, what is your philosophy that you're trying to implement? Not so much the broad picture of maybe what a conservative school looks like. We can guess, I think, to some extent.
Yeah.
Tell
no,
me,
you
try
can.
To get into try to get into what it is that you believe about education and raising children, and if it meshes with this other school.
Well, yeah, and I don't know that it does. I mean, I think that, you know, we're at three different points. There's the traditional school, there's this alternative school, and there's my perspective, which I would say is significantly more radical than the alternative school.
Give us a radical perspective on school and child rearing. That's what I want to get back into here now.
Okay, I believe in children. I believe in human beings. I watch two-year-olds in my office. And I see that there's no distinction for them between learning and play. They're excited. They're exploring. I think we systematically turn that off by what we do to children in school, where we and you know to me the twin evils are coercion and assessment. We compare and rate and judge students' work, and we tell them to do things they don't want to do. To me, that's a recipe for disengagement. And I think is reflected in the fact that such a high percentage of kids disengage from school. What I believe and what my model is and what we have periodically tried to actualize in the community here, what my model is essentially the people refer to this as unschooling. But the idea is that you provide children resources, you provide children encouragement, and you let them do what they want to do. And you don't value it, you don't assess it. It's believing that children will learn what they need to learn. It's a very radical concept for people because what winds up happening when you do this is that learning is very uneven. You know what I mean? So you might have a six-year-old who speaks some Latin but doesn't know the alphabet. You know, you might have a 12-year-old who knows a lot about metaphysics but can't do a times table. And my feeling is that, I mean, there's several layers to this. I think we learn what we need to learn and what we want to learn. And I also don't think learning itself is that important. I don't think it makes us happy. My interest in the school really has very little to do with education. It has to do with treating children in a way that's consistent with their healthy and positive emotional development. So that's the idea. The idea is that if a child came into the center, and it would be a center, not a school, if a child came into the center and spent the whole day laying down in the mud, that would not be valued any differently than if a child came in and spent the whole day writing a treatise that wound up coming up with a cure for AIDS. Both of those things would be valued the same, because the idea is that a human being's worth is intrinsic. A human being's worth, in my view, ought not to be contingent on what they produce or what they do, which is, you know, as you mentioned, my book is called Perfect Parents, Perfect Children. It doesn't mean perfect in the way of doing everything a certain way. It means we're already perfect. We're the perfect manifestation of ourselves. And so the idea, my idea for radical education would be children being able to spend every day where they are celebrated for their own uniqueness. They are encouraged to stay in touch with their own voice and their own authenticity, you know, where they're encouraged essentially to be the most powerful manifestation of themselves, whether it pleases anyone else, whether it's what someone else expects, that they are essentially loved, reinforced, honored, esteemed for just being who they are.
To what extent have you been able to see what happens when this is actually applied?
That's a great question, Peter. And, you know, it's one I get fairly often because people say, oh, this is a great theory, but it doesn't work in real life. Because of living in this community, like I said, there's kids who were raised in this way before I ever got here. Now, their parents have had a difficult time finding schools to send them to, with the result that many of these kids wind up being homeschooled. So there, at least the oldest one I know of kids who were raised in these non-traditional ways is probably like 20 now. And he did, when he went to uni, he sort of complained a little bit that he didn't feel he had the academic, skills to succeed. However, what happened is he developed them. You know, I mean, to me, he's sort of an example of both sides of this. When I actually first met him, that's what he was saying, that he had gone to an alternative. He was not homeschooled. He went to an alternative school. But he was saying, yeah, I loved it, and I feel good about myself, but I don't feel like I have the academic readiness to compete in a traditional uni, which makes sense that he wouldn't. But about a year later, he was doing great at uni. So whatever he did in that intervening year, he got himself up to speed. The other kids who I know who are raised this way, and again, you know, we always see things that validate our own perceptions. So this could partly be my own bias to want to see things this way. But the kids I see who are raised non-traditionally feel qualitatively different than me and those of us who were raised traditionally. And the qualitative difference for me does not have to do with joy. It has to do with peace. It has to do with a sense that everything's okay. You know, at the end of the day, external events have less ability to shake my world because I have a steady belief in myself. I know who I am. I know I can listen to my own voice. So, yeah, I mean, it'll always feel better to have people tell us we're awesome than for people to tell us we're horrible. But it doesn't have to define me. It doesn't have to define my day. So that's what I would, you know, it's kind of like that feeling you get when you're around someone who feels very centered and very calm. That's how these kids feel to me.
And most of them have been homeschooled or have been in the center, or?
No, I'd say most of them have been homeschooled. The one boy I was talking about, his dad actually ran a very alternative school, but it shut down 4 or 5 years ago. And I didn't, that was sort of before I got real. Maybe it might have even been 6 years ago. So I don't know that much about that model.
I think homeschooling has a lot to offer, children. I think it's in many ways a very good model, especially when it involves lots of interaction with other kids outside the home and, maybe some experiences outside the home. But using your model of it doesn't matter whether a kid lies in the mud all day, and I know you picked an extreme model, or if they create something really grand, most homeschooling that I know is aimed at helping children grow up, helping them mature, helping them learn, helping them be prepared for society. Do you think that's not true in the homeschooling you're looking at? Do you think it's more your model of somehow letting the child bring it out of themselves?
I think it's both. I think there's lots of different models of homeschooling. I think there's some parents who homeschool and essentially try to replicate a school in their home. I mean, I knew one parent who actually set up desks and pencil cases and, got a whole bunch of worksheets and had two children, so put the desks in a row, and essentially was trying to make her house like a mini school. On the other hand, I know parents who are homeschooling in this very unschooling way where there's no structured activities. I think every parent I know who's homeschooling makes a conscious effort to do some sort of social, interaction, because obviously that's a concern about homeschooling if a child were to be home by him or herself all the time. So, as far as I know, everybody does that. But for me, you made an interesting comment about preparing children for society. And I talk about in my book that it's sort of each of us has to make the decision of what is our job as parents. Obviously, if we raise our children non-traditionally, they might be less prepared to fit into society. They'd certainly be less prepared to fit into mainstream schools, for example. They might be less prepared to make a lot of friends. They might be less prepared to fit into mainstream vocational roles. So is that our goal? And there's certainly a coherent argument to be made. My feeling, obviously, is that there's an argument to be made that we want change in the world. There's so many of us who, spend our whole lives lamenting things like violence and racism and poverty. And I think those things change, like I said, from the bottom up. So I would love to see a world of people who are intolerant of those kinds of things. And then I think they would stop. We have a tendency to go to leaders and try to get them to make changes, but they don't want to make changes because this system benefits them. So anyway, obviously I have a very strong bias about this. My bias being that if we raise children to feel good about themselves, they may not fit in so well in society, but they won't care so much about not fitting in because that won't be how they define their self-worth.
Do you think that children raised like this would become reformers like you and I, who felt some sort of moral imperative to make things better?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think it will. Not only that, but there'll be people who were certainly braver than me. I needed you as a young professional. I needed you, your validation, to have the courage to stand up and speak out. And I think since then, people have needed my validation to stand up and speak out. I'm sure you continue to validate people all the time. What I would hope is that, and I not only would hope, I see it, I think these people are young people who will speak out about whatever their truth is and not be so inhibited by the things that inhibited me, like concern about what everybody else thinks, like, you know, my ego investment in my professional reputation, you know, wanting to look good personally and professionally, wanting to start, you know, sound informed, you know, wanting the psychiatrists I looked up to think I was really smart and not some sort of radical hippie. I think had I been raised in a way where I knew my own sense of self-worth, you know, as well as I knew the back of my hand, I think those issues would be less. So, yeah, I would envision people being much freer to speak out about these issues. And I think I already see it. I see it in these kids. These kids are activists in many ways. And I think it's because they don't, I wouldn't say they don't care, but they care less about the idea of how they look to everybody else, and they're comfortable knowing their own voice and honoring it.
My suspicion is that they're activists in ways their parents approve. That's my suspicion.
What did you say? Activists in the way their parents approve?
Yeah, that's my suspicion. They're not going to come out and deny global warming. They're not going to say the hell with the platypuses. I think that they are going to, like most children, want, whether they're raised that way or not, to fit in. And and the reason they look more radical is because their parents are more radical in terms of being leftist radical, and they'll pursue that. That's my guess. Am I being too cynical?
I suspect that's probably true. Certainly the parents who embrace alternative parenting probably tend to be socially and politically way more radical than parents who don't. But
radical,
I mean,
radical to the left.
Yeah, radical to the left. But I think part
so
of the...
So then the kids look activist, but they're actually like our kids in colleges who are... But now they're being activists. They're doing exactly what the professors want them to do.
Well, you know, again,
I don't mean to be self-challenging.
No, part of the parenting approach, part of sort of the core of what non-traditional parenting is valuing children the same, whether they please you or not, whether they achieve or not, whether they conform or not. So the idea, theoretically, anyway, would be that if your child says, yeah, I want to march about, you know, warning about global warming, you would have the same reaction to that as if your child said, I wanted to march saying global warming is a myth. So, you know, I do think, again, there's only one who's an adult, so it's not like I have a whole sample of
kids, adults who've been raised
this way. But I do see kids in high school espousing things that their parents don't agree with. You know, I don't know that it's on the level of, you know, debunking global warming, but, you know, that are not necessarily their parents' issues. Either they're different ones or their parents have a different stance on it. But the idea is that their parents celebrate it, you know, that if their children disagree with them, it's not only not a bad thing, but it's actually a lovely thing. But that has to go back to when your child doesn't pick up the towel when, you know, he's 2 years old. How do you handle that? You know, do you handle that as an ego power-based thing where you have to make him do it? Or do you handle that as a celebration of his autonomy and his, you know, self-efficacy? Do you handle that as a celebration of the fact that your child, of course, is in control of himself, will make his own decision, and doesn't have to make it based on what you want, and doesn't have to make it based on the fact that you have power, you know, in relation to him?
I think this is very interesting, and I think, you know, as we chatted earlier, we have huge disagreements about human nature. It echoes a little bit my disagreements with my friend Jeffrey Mason over the issue of the perfectibility of people, or as I believe, are human beings, in fact, profoundly, deeply conflicted, born with violent impulses, born with loving impulses, born with a desire to dominate, and born with a desire to cooperate, and that they need to be raised in ways that encourage their best It'd be very interesting to try to imagine, if it's ever happened, that a child was raised, having a little hoarseness, a child was ever raised like that, where the child had no, in a sense, you're saying, no responsibilities at all, which is something I, back in the 60s, did advocate, but did not continue to advocate. What happens in a family when one member has no responsibilities to the others?
You know what
or
happens,
do they
Peter,
have responsibilities?
Is what happens actually on the ground is people develop an awesome sense of responsibility, but it's self-motivated. It's not motivated by fear, and it's not outer-directed. It's not motivated by trying to please. There are so many, I can't tell you how many parents in Mulaney and in this area in general now respond to things in a very different way. So if the towel is on the floor and they say to a child, would you please pick up the towel? And if the child says no, and the parent might respond by saying, well, good on you for knowing that the only one who can make you do stuff is yourself. And you know what? I'll pick up that towel for you. Don't worry about it. That the result is, and of course, this is very consistent with my view about the nature of humans, the result is that child becomes, uber responsible. That child tends to look for ways to help out. That child tends to seek cooperation. I can't tell you how many parents, and I mean, obviously I'm just one person, so it's not like thousands, but, I work with dozens of families where discipline is just not even an issue. And the reason it's not an issue is because everybody is motivated to help each other and to cooperate, kind of like that utopian model. Either I'm seeing it work, or people are just telling me it's working to make me feel good because they like me. You know what I mean? Certainly that's, I'm getting that kind of feedback from the families that I work with. People are saying like, wow, I was fighting with her over this for months, but once I just get on her side about it and support her decision and help her out, she responds by helping me out. I'm a huge believer in role modeling. I'm a huge believer that as parents, we have an opportunity to just be the person we want our children to be. So if we want to teach responsibility, be responsible. If we want to teach cooperation, be cooperative. Instead of telling our child, you need to carry your weight around the house, go to our child and say, is there anything else I can do for you? Is there anything that I'm not doing that I could, any way that I could help you out? And again, in my experience, what it engenders is a child learning that, a child taking that on board, and a child then wanting to be as helpful as he or she can be.
I definitely think that role modeling is the most essential aspect, that if you treat children with respect, they are more likely to learn respect. If you love them, they're more likely to be loving.
Yeah.
However, I'm not sure about some of the other aspects of it. Excuse me. How in your working with families, what do you do when a child is disrespectful, consistently disrespectful?
Okay, so the first thing I would, that's a great question, and because, as a child psychologist, a lot of the referrals I get even, still continue to be parents are dissatisfied with a child's behavior. So I think the first thing I would do is I'd try to get an understanding from the parents of what they are considering disrespectful and why that essentially is a trigger for them. Like, what is there about that communication that feels bad for them?
And give you an example. I'm this little kid, and I really like to tick my mother off. I know her vulnerabilities. I like to tick her off. I don't want to get up in the morning. I don't want to go to school on time. Mm-hmm. I forget things all the time. And if my mother asks me to get ready on time, I give her a raft of, what? I make it hard on my parents. I don't talk in a respectful tone of voice. And, that's just a general outline. How do you begin with that?
The way I would begin with that is by trying to understand the motivation behind the child's behavior. There's a foundational principle of my philosophy, which, again, it might be our disagreement about human nature, but I believe that human beings are basically good. I don't think people have negative motivations. I believe that about you and me. I believe that about our children, and I believe that about all human beings. You know, if you show me a newborn infant, it's going to be very hard to convince me that that infant has any kind of malicious intent. So now we see this young child, I don't know, you know, in the scenario you gave, who's causing all sorts of grief, who seems to be purposefully doing stuff to be annoying to his parents. What I would say is, the way I would analyze this in my own head and then talk to the parents about is, we need to figure out what is the purpose of the behavior. We all of us do things for a reason. Human behavior is purposeful. Obviously, that's not true if we trip and fall, but if we go back to the same place and keep tripping, then yeah, it is. So my analysis would be, human behavior is purposeful. This is a choice. It's not like your child is thinking you're going to like it when he talks to you in a mean way. He knows you're not going to like it, but he's choosing to do it anyway. So then the question would be, why is he making that choice? Most often, again, in my view and the philosophy that I utilize, most often it has to do with getting a security need met. The thing that helps, that, you know, all human beings, I think, genetically are predisposed to insecurity because we're a dependent species. You know, we're a species that if other people don't take care of us, we essentially can't survive. And so I think we have a certain amount of biological insecurity. And then various things in life exacerbate that insecurity. When children feel insecure, the thing that makes them feel better is intense emotional engagement with their primary caregiver. So in the same way that it helps a two-week-old, if mom or dad, but usually it's mom in our culture, picks him up and holds him very, very closely and maybe even, you know, is very engaged with him, he then can relax like a, you know, his weight drops and he relaxes and goes to sleep. The theory behind that is that he knows that you are completely engaged with him. He is safe. He doesn't have to worry. He can go to sleep. That doesn't change to me as children get older. It's just the way that they get that need met changes. You know, a seven-year-old doesn't cry and get picked up and cuddled. He's probably too physically demanding. But so the question then becomes, what does the seven-year-old get as a result of this behavior? And just in like sort of a traditional behavioral analysis, in my opinion, the best way to figure out motivation for behavior is figure out what happens as a result. You know, if every time I hit my hand on the desk, someone gives me $20, it's pretty obvious that's why I'm hitting my hand on the desk. It's less obvious, why is this perfect, good child choosing to do these provocative, unpleasant behaviors? So the idea, I would then ask myself, okay, so what happens as a result? He's making this choice. He's not dumb. He's making these choices. What does he get as a result? And very often what mom and dad will say to me is, well, we ground him, or we yell at him, or we have a talk to him about why this is wrong, you know, or unfortunately in some cases they'll say we smack him. I mean, whatever the various thing is, they engage with him because of his provocative behavior. And I think it's almost a universal that children learn at a very young age that it's easier to get engagement with parents through negative behavior than positive. This was true with my children. They very rarely, you know, engaged in any negative behavior, but if we all came home and they went off and did whatever they were doing, which is what they usually did, I would get busy with other things. You know, I'd get busy with making dinner or returning a phone call. But on the rarer occasions where they came home and had a problem, or if they were arguing with each other, I would stop what I was doing and I would go to them to try to mediate it or go to them to try to sort it out. So my children, and I knew I was doing it and I did it anyway. It's a very hard habit to break. But my children knew that if they did what I wanted, the energy went away from them. If they did what I didn't want, the energy went towards them. It wasn't a big problem in my case. I think hopefully, you know, there weren't a lot of things that were huge security issues. So I may have lucked out in that way. But if my kids had a period of time or if they were feeling super insecure, in my view, what they would have done is acted out in a way that got me engaged. Sometimes it's not behavioral. Sometimes it's emotional. Sometimes you have a situation where a parent will come in and say, I'm very upset because my child is crying every night. And one of my first questions, even before I meet the child, is what happens as a result of the crying? You know, and sometimes the answer is, well, I go in there and we have really good talks. You know, we'll spend an hour talking about what's upsetting him. And I might ask, well, how often do you have those talks otherwise? And the answer might be, well, you know, not very often. Life is very busy. So I'm thinking, you know, children are brilliant. Like, this child is able, has come up with something. And it's not like Machiavellian. I think it's subconscious. You know, I don't think he's thinking, aha, I'm in a fake crying. I think he genuinely feels the emotions that lead to crying. But the subconscious motivation is that his security need is enhanced. So again, back to your scenario, I think when there's that kind of unpleasant behavior going on, there's a reason for it. And I will, again, this is a choice, not necessarily right, but I will dismiss the theory that he's a bad kid or he's naughty or any of those kinds of things. I will go with the theory that he's a good person who's making a decision to be incredibly annoying or, you know, provocative, and then the question becomes why. Did that answer your question?
No, it's a great answer. I didn't interrupt.
I wanted to make sure I wasn't rambling incoherently because I do
no,
have a tendency to do
no.
that.
No, you were recovering things.
Okay. Good.
I think that a lot of practical application of parenting that we might suggest to people would not be so different necessarily, but I think that there are implications to the difference in opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't get too deeply into this in the remaining time, but I think that children are born, all of us are born, with a mixture of various instinctual capacities.
Mm-hmm.
One of those instinctual capacities is when thwarted, we get angry and willful. And we might get thwarted by not getting the candy we want. We might get thwarted by the existence of a younger child who now does require some of mom and dad's attention when we used to get it all.
Right, inevitably.
So we can be thwarted by a whole variety of things, and that, in fact, we do have a natural response to being thwarted, which is to be aggressive and willful and domineering.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's genetic. I think its expression differs to some extent in women and men, and that's not entirely even socialization, that some of that's biologic, because men are more able to naturally get physical. That's built into us to do that when we're thwarted, and less so perhaps in women. I think that we are born with a lot of biological responses which aren't the best in the world, and which evolved in very different situations that we live in than now. When we were living in small units of hunter-gatherers, which is how human nature evolved, violence was an extremely important part of our way of life as hunters, as fighters. It had to be. Whether you think there was warfare, there's no doubt there was violence of all kinds in the past. Again, I think some anthropologists who don't want to see that don't see it. But it's just not by coincidence that every single tribe we've ever looked at has had a lot of murder and violence and revenge and hatred and the suspicions of other groups, and needed elaborate rituals to prevent violence against other groups and so on. I do think that. I don't know that it has to change our approach to each individual child in terms of unconditional love, but I think it needs to influence our overall expectation of that we're not going to ever have a utopian society, that we need more of a society like our founders imagined, tried to build, which is checks and balances to preserve individual liberty. I also, it'd be interesting, you know, because I think a lot of what we're suggesting goes to the same direction. I tell parents to let the little things go, but to insist on respectful relating, to be respectful, and to insist on respectful relating. And if you respect that and you get respect, then everything else flows. But I do tell parents that they have to teach respect to children, because children will naturally take advantage. They will naturally have two sides. They may give the cookie away one moment when they're 2 years old, and the next moment steal the neighbor's cookie. So some of this is largely different, and some of it is largely the same, and I think it's a real complicated world we live in. But I'm going to let you talk some more now, because I think you're saying interesting things. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking that whenever I do quite a bit of workshops and stuff, and whenever I do them, I always preface them at the beginning with that there's two. I always tell people I'm not necessarily right, which is certainly true. You know, I'm just giving my opinions about stuff, and I'm happy for other people to have different opinions. I think that diversity is awesome, and I have no need to be right. But I do say that in understanding my philosophy and what I'm going to be talking about parenting is that there are two core foundational beliefs. And this really came up for me as you were talking. I always say to parents, if you don't agree with one or both of these, that's fine, and I'm not right about them. They're just beliefs. But that my philosophy is, you know, based on these, it stems from these beliefs. And so what I suggest is, as I'm talking, if there's something that kind of sticks in your craw, you might go back and think, is that because I don't really agree with Bob on one of these foundational beliefs? And the two foundational beliefs are, one, that we can do better as a society, that we're not doing the best we can. You know, if you think that, not you personally, but if anyone thinks, hey, our world is as good as it can be, and people are as happy as they can be as adults, then, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I think we're all plagued by problems of self-esteem. We're plagued by being self-conscious. We're plagued by being people pleasers. You know, we're plagued by health issues and obesity and things like, and high blood pressure. And I don't think we're doing as well as we could in our society. But obviously, if someone did, then my philosophy would be kind of ridiculous. Why radically change parenting if what we're doing now is great? So that's number one. And then number two is a fundamental belief that human beings are good. And I think that might be the place where you and I are kind of diverging on this, again, which is fine. But my belief is that, yeah, of course, I think we all have animals as well. If you want something and you don't get it, you feel a certain amount of frustration. But I don't think we need, you know, I don't think there's anything negative about that. I think we can celebrate that and try to alleviate power as much as possible. I think, yeah, the indiscriminate use of power is so much how our whole world is based, you know, that big people tell little people what to do, and strong people tell weak people what to do, and, you know, ethnic and cultural majorities tell ethnic and cultural minorities what to do. And children, both by size and stature, are inherently disenfranchised and become very frustrated by the fact that they have no power and they have no say and they have no control. You know, and the idea of responsibility, to me, responsibility, in my opinion, can't exist without control. We ask children to be responsible over a world in which they really don't have any control. But my point is that I think the thing that we're running up against is just a belief, and which, again, my belief is not necessarily right in any way, but I do believe in human beings. I do believe in their inherent goodness. You know, we talked earlier about how, you know, I've read a bunch of stuff about how there was very little intertribal, you know, human violence in 40,000 years of indigenous history in Australia. I wasn't there. You know what I mean? You've obviously done way more reading than I have, and you've read that there's been a tremendous amount of violence in indigenous cultures, both here
and
elsewhere.
In Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah, so yeah. I mean, I wasn't there and you weren't there, but one of the things you helped teach me is to always be wary of the agendas of people who are writing things and are telling us stuff. You know, yeah. When I was doing my internship in the psychiatric setting, I would read articles about how ADHD is a neurobiological disorder.
Yeah.
And you would remind me, find out who's sponsoring that article. You know, I've passed that along to students for 20 years, yeah. You know, not in the way that it's right or wrong, but just find out what the agenda is of the author. And we all have an agenda. I mean, I have an agenda in talking to you. You have an agenda in talking to me. We all have an agenda. And so because neither you nor I were there in these indigenous cultures, I would think everything we're both reading probably has a bias or a spin on it.
Yeah.
So we're both going to choose to believe.
Yeah. Let me interrupt a second, Bob.
Go ahead.
Because we've got probably about 2 minutes left.
Time flies,
Yeah, well, I'm really letting you talk because it's really interesting to hear you talk.
Thank you.
I do think there is a big difference, but in many ways it turns out probably in how we operate not to be so big in our practical lives. I always assume people are good, but I know that in fact to be a good person requires huge work to overcome this sexual aggressive side of ourselves, which in fact often comes out in terrible ways, whether or not we were in a utopian society or not, in my own opinion. So in a way, we act very similarly because my wife teases me how I always assume the best about my clients or patients. I always assume their goodness. But when I'm thinking about folks in general, I don't think that way at all. I always assume my kids are basically good and so on. But when I look at the world, I know that that's a good assumption in your personal life, provided you don't let it mislead you into how much people can turn out not to behave in a good way. So it's a kind of a mixed and complex thing. But I think I approach this with overall a much greater skepticism. For ending,
Bob, I hear music.
In a word, Bob, how do people find you?
Find me at theparentingcenter.com.
Say it again.
And there's all sorts of information and contact details there.
Say it once more.
Theparentingcenter.com. And center is spelled C-E-N-T-R-E. C-E-N-T-R-E for The Parenting Center.
Glad to have you aboard. Bye, oh, wonderful.
It's a pleasure talking to you, Peter. You take care.
Bye.